You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 293, Exodus 23:20-33. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you this week?
Pretty good. Been a productive week, except for, of course, fantasy football. Go ahead. Enjoy it.
Yeah. I finally
tell everybody.
I got my win. I finally got a win. And guess who is now in last place? Who is that, yep. Mike? Have you seen the rankings, the standings?
Yep. That would, yes. The pugnacious pugs are in last place. I am one of 5 1-3 teams, but I'm ranked last because of my point total.
That's fun. I saw that and I started laughing. I'm sorry, but
I know
it's better you than me because it's been me on the bottom.
I know you couldn't wait.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it. Enjoy it. It's not going to last long. We're going to be on the rebound here.
I hear you. It's not fun being on the bottom.
Yep. Yeah, I hear you.
All right. Well,
so other than that.
Yeah. Well, Mike, you know, as we speak, our conference is going on. So I hope we're doing good. I hope everybody's having fun.
Yeah, I hope we're doing good, too.
I hope everybody showed up.
Nothing's crashing and burning. Yeah, right.
Yeah, last year we had major thunderstorms and the whole power went out in the whole hotel. So right in the middle of the conference. So that was fun for me to get all of that stuff back up.
It's going to go better.
Yeah.
This I'm sure this one's going better. So no worries.
Yeah. Well, if you are not physically at the conference, you can still watch it on demand for the next 3 months. So go to nakedbibleconference.com and check it out, please.
Yeah. Well, we're going to finish Exodus 23 today. You know, it's about time. We've been doing chapters 21 through 23, and we left a little bit of 23 at the end, and that's what we're going to cover today. So it's Exodus 23 verses 20 through 33. That's the end of the chapter. And, you know, honestly, I'm not going to say too much about some parts of this because there's a lot of unseen realm territory here, but I'm just going to jump in and read a little bit, and then I'll stop at various points. So you know what? I think I'll just read the whole thing and then we'll jump in. And those of you who have read Unseen Realm are going to kind of know, you know, where the touch points are as far as the book. And again, if you haven't read the book, I'm sorry, but you need to read the book because I'm not going to repeat the book in the podcast, but I will say something about the stuff that the book does touch on. So verse 20 begins this way. Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way, to bring you to the place that I have prepared. This, of course, is God speaking to Moses. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you, and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out before you until you have increased and possess the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the Euphrates, and I will give, for I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me, for if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And that's verses 20 through 33, the end of Exodus 23. And again, there's obvious touch points here. This Exodus passage is part of the two powers idea. It begins with this comment about sending an angel before the Israelites and the name of God being in the angel. So that's two powers territory. The two Yahwehs idea, again, that we discuss in Unseen Realm. And if you want additional data, you need to read the book. It's chapters 16 through 18 specifically, and that focuses on the Old Testament data behind the two powers in heaven of later Judaism. Of course, Judaism declared that a heresy in the second century AD, which coincides with the advent of Christianity. But this idea of a Godhead is based in Old Testament data. So we've got two Yahweh figures. You've got a transcendent, invisible Yahweh and a visible, present Yahweh. Two of them, sometimes they're in the same scene at the same time. The angel is one of these figures, but certainly not the only one. And other times they are, you know, they appear separately. So if you're listening to this, again, I'm well acquainted with evangelical and otherwise positions that avoid trying to see some of these things, especially like seeing the angel of Yahweh as Yahweh himself. And I address the weaknesses of such avoidances in the book and provide a number of sources for that critique. It's not just me. You know, you really can't take that position and pay attention to passages like Genesis 48, 15, and 16, where you have the angel and God fused together really in the dialogue in Jacob's prayer by a singular verb, may he bless these boys. Well, who's he? Well, it's God, one stanza, God in the second stanza, the angel in the third stanza. So, and the verb is singular. It's not may they bless the boys, it's may he. And this is Jacob's assessment of the events in his life that involve Yahweh, the four consonants, you know, the divine name. And he refers to Yahweh as Ha Elohim and also Ha Malach, the angel, in that passage. So, you know, and I think that passage also addresses the secular approach, you know, the critical non-confessional or Jewish, you know, scholarly approach that the angel only seems equated with Yahweh because of this, you know, messenger formula. The messenger was understood to represent the king, and so that's why you get first-person language and so on and so forth. You know, when the angel shows up, he speaks as Yahweh because that's what messengers do. They represent. They're the proxies for who sent them. Well, that's all well and good, but that doesn't work with Genesis 48, 15, and 16 because the angel doesn't speak. Again, this is Jacob's assessment of the episodes in his life that involved Yahweh directly. And this is the terminology that Jacob uses. So again, you know, we've got this two Yahwehs idea. In this passage in Exodus 23, the key idea is that Yahweh's name is in this angel. Again, the standard messenger formula approach sort of ignores that detail. It ignores the name theology. Again, I'm also aware that some scholars, including evangelicals, don't really like the name theology. Again, they want to distance themselves, you know, from it. Other scholars, though, recently, Michael Hundley is one I'll mention here. His work is really important here. They have rebutted these denials, including the fairly recent work by Sandra Richter, who teaches at Wheaton. You know, Richter is one who, again, distances herself, you know, from the what has traditionally been called name theology. And again, Hundley's work really, again, addresses her criticisms and frankly just lays them to rest. So some of that is in Unseen Realm. Other parts are in, you know, some of the published journal articles I've done. So I'm well aware that the name theology isn't universally accepted. Well, hey, nothing is universally accepted in scholarship. But what we're saying in Unseen Realm and what we're saying here is on good ground, good, solid, scholarly ground. So those of you who are new to this, you need to know that. And I'm not going to be, you know, surprised, you know, by any criticisms. They've all been addressed either by me or by somebody else. Now, the short version of this, though, since I'm not going to reproduce Unseen Realm content, is I'm just going to read a little section from the Faith Life Study Bible. I did a lot of the notes did the majority of the notes for the Torah and Joshua and Judges. And I did a lot of the sidebars for that study Bible. One of them is called Old Testament Godhead Language. So I'm just going to read an excerpt here. The relationship between Yahweh and the angel of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, provides the most familiar example of two Yahwehs. The Old Testament writers at times deliberately make the angel of Yahweh indistinguishable from Yahweh. Example, Exodus 3, 1 through 14, that's the burning bush. For instance, according to Exodus 23, the angel has Yahweh's name in him. This passage gives a glimpse of the Hebrew Bible's name theology, in which reference to the name actually refers to Yahweh himself. Thus, in Exodus 23, Yahweh indicates that he is in the angel. And yet in other passages, Yahweh and the angel can be simultaneously but separately present. Judges 6 is an example. Various Old Testament passages attribute God's deliverance of Israel from Egypt to both the God of Israel and the angel. Judges 2, 1 through 3, 1 Samuel 8, 8, Micah 6, 4. In light of Deuteronomy 4:37, which states the presence, panim, of Yahweh was responsible for Israel's deliverance from Egypt, these passages provide a constructive case for binitarianism, a Godhead with two Yahwehs in it. The divine presence, of course, is Yahweh himself, his essence. Perhaps most tellingly in this theology is the text of Genesis 48:15-16, which fuses God and the angel, Jacob, near death and pronouncing blessing on Joseph's sons, speaks of God's saving action in a way that highlights the fusion of Yahweh and the angel. Again, the point there is the singular verb. It may he bless the boys, not may they, even though we've got Elohim and the angel as, you know, apparently separate entities. But the verb there puts them together, may he bless the boys, because they're interchangeable. That's the point. Now, we also have, you know, in this regard, the captain of Yahweh's host. This is, I'm out of the Faith Life Study Bible now, just to make a few other comments. There's other ways to approach this. You know, we have the burning bush incident in Exodus, where Moses is told by God to remove his sandals from his feet because he's on holy ground. You see that language in Joshua 5, where the captain of the Lord's host appears to Joshua. He looks like any other man. You know, Joshua says, "Are you friend or foe?" And he says, "I'm the captain of the Lord's host. Take your shoes off from where you stand, because you're standing on holy ground." The key phrase there, I mean, it, obviously that language links the reader's mind back to Exodus 3, where God himself is present. And of course, the angel is in the bush. But the phrase in Joshua 5 of the captain of the Lord's host, that he had hit a drawn sword in his hand. That phrase in Hebrew, if you search it, it occurs only two other times. Numbers 22, 1 Chronicles, both of which refer to the figure of the angel of the Lord. So again, there are a number of ways to get to these points. Enough of that, you can read the book. But this passage is significant. It has a lot of theological significance, but we're going to move on to the rest of it, the things that aren't necessarily or in as much detail in Unseen Realm. Now, the passage itself, you know, the sort of the commentary after we read about the angel, you get to verse 23, when my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and then you get this list, you know, the grocery list of pre-Israelite inhabitants. And so that's what, you know, what we're looking at here. That's the context. So I want to share some observations, you know, on not only those points, and but a few things all the way through to the end. But we're gonna actually end up, you know, with the grocery list. So it starts here in verse 23, but we're gonna end up in our discussion for this episode. I'm gonna try to spend a little bit of time on that specifically, but until we get back to them, to the people groups, we're just gonna go through the passage and, you know, just hit a few things as is our pattern. Verse 24, I think this is significant. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do. Okay, it's very apparent, and I'm going to just telegraph where I'm going to end up here. The list of names, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites, those names are significant. This is going to sound a little bit odd, but the conquest, and again, this much you already know from Unseen Realm if you've read it, the conquest isn't just indiscriminate. It's not just, oh, we got to go in there and fight battles. The conquest is about kickstarting the return to Eden. It's about avoiding and defeating chaos. Okay, chaos enemies. And chaos, again, is defined in Old Testament theology as all that is opposed to the way God wants things to be. It is anti-Eden. It is represented metaphorically by Babel in many places, Babylon. this is what the conquest is actually about. It's about establishing, reestablishing Eden, you know, a place where God is going to come to dwell on earth. And that's what, I mean, God talks about the journey to Canaan in that way. When you get in the land, you know, I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. Okay. There's this thing about establishing his name in the place, you know, in a certain place. It's temple language. This is what it's about. It's about reestablishing the Edenic presence, the Edenic dream, God's original plan on earth, and defeating anti-Eden, everything that opposes that. And that's the way we need to understand the conquest, and that's therefore the way we need to look at the names. Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, there's something there that isn't obvious to us on the surface, but to an ancient reader, there would have been things that stood out. We do get verse 24 that telegraphs very clearly that this is about the defeat and the dismissal of other gods. You know, you shall not bow down to their gods or serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. There's a religious and an inherently religious theological element that drives the conquest narratives. It's not just about having a place to live. There's something, there's more going on here than that. And believe it or not, a lot of that is revealed in these names. We're going to spend, again, a little bit of time at the end of the episode on that. You go to verse 25, early verses 25 and 26. Let me read those. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water. Now think about this. He shall bless your bread and your water. And again, I will serve, this is God speaking, I will take, you know, I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. Now we've had the fall in Genesis 3, and the curse of the fall is mortality. Okay, humans were not created to die, but when the events of Genesis 3 happen, they are driven from Eden, the place where life is, because God is there. God is the source of life. Humans are estranged from God. And again, the story is about losing immortality. So we're still in that condition, but look at what God is saying about the land. It's Edenic in its feel. I'm going to bless your bread and your water. You're going to have enough to eat and drink. Okay, there's going to be abundance there. I will take sickness away from you. It's Edenic. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. It's Edenic. And there, all of these things, these hardship conditions, these tragic, you know, circumstances of life, none of them are associated in any way in Genesis with Eden. In fact, Eden is the exact opposite of this, being fruitful and multiplying and having abundance and all these things. So, again, the description of the conquest is cast in this restoration of Eden idea. And the flip side of that coin is the defeat, the opposition to chaos. And all that is anti-Eden is opposed to the way God wants things. In verse 27, we read, I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against you, or against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. Now, what's interesting here is this notion of God sending his terror. Like, well, you know, what does that mean? This language actually shows up two other times. There's Deuteronomy 2:25. Let me read that to you. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you on the peoples who are under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. Now, this is, again, a foreshadowing. When the Israelites go in to conquer the land, the people are going to be in a panic. Okay, and God is going to be behind that. God is going to, you know, put them in this state of mind. This is like psychological warfare. Okay, but God's saying, well, I'm gonna put them in this condition. You know, and Deuteronomy 2:25 gives us a bit of the means, you know, by which God is going to do that. The other reference is Joshua 2:9. And this is when they're in the land, you know, they're reconnoitering Jericho. Okay, we know that story. So if we go to Joshua 2:9, let me just click to that, get a little bit of the contents here. This is when Rahab is hiding the two spies. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. And it's just this it's an illustration of what God had said back in Deuteronomy and back here in Exodus 23, 27, I will send my terror before you and throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. You know, and then Deuteronomy 2:25, that language, you know, the people, they're going to be in dread and fear of you. Again, this is God caused. These people have soldiers. They have armies. They have walled cities. You know, ostensibly, there's no specific reason to fear the Israelites, who are not a trained militia, okay? They've just spent, you know, hundreds of years in slavery and bondage in Egypt. This is not a trained army. Ostensibly, there's no reason why any of these other trained armies, you know, who have battle experience should be fearing this bunch. And, you know, God knows that. And God says, look, I'm going to take care of that detail. I will put my fear and dread, you know, I'm just going to poison their minds with it. They're going to be in a panic. But that's important when you get to verse 28, okay, all of that. Because I'm going to suggest that this reference to God putting his terror and the dread upon the inhabitants of the land should lead us to interpret the next verse in a certain way. And here's the next verse. I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. Now, again, I think we need to factor in these other references to God imposing, again, psychological warfare here, poisoning the minds, as it were, of the occupants of the land with fear and dread. Because when you get to this verse, you know, like everybody asks, what in the world, what are the hornets? What's that? And you have a few options, you know, at the outset. Well, it could be literal insect warfare. So God sent literal insect swarms to drive out the inhabitants of Canaan. Do we ever read that in the conquest accounts? Nope. Number two is God sent a plague, like plagues, you know, carried by insects, okay, on the inhabitants of Canaan. So God sent disease, and that was a factor in the conquest. Do we ever read about that in the conquest accounts? Nope. Third option is the language is a metaphor for human armies. This is a little more interesting. Now, that does happen elsewhere. There are other passages where, you know, armies are described as, you know, scorpions. Okay, there's Old Testament, you know, material for that. You know, happens a couple times, or, you know, like a swarm of locusts, like the book of Joel, you know, which is both an actual locust swarm, and then the language is used for invading armies. Okay, so that kind of thing does happen in the Old Testament. But it makes little sense here because of Joshua 24:12. Okay, let me read Joshua 24:12. God, again, this is the covenant renewal at Shechem. Joshua gathers the tribes in verse 1. Joshua said to all the people in verse 2, thus says the Lord God of Israel. And then Joshua starts narrating. Now, you know, it's cast as God speaking through Joshua. Maybe this was written down, you know, Revelation or something like that. But you get down to verse 12, and the speaker there, I gave them into your hand. This is the voice of God again through Joshua. You know, I gave them into your hand, verse 12. You know, this is right after a list: Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites. I gave them into your land, and I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out before you, the two kings of the Amorites, Sihon and Og. Okay. You know, I sent the hornet before you, and one of the effects was that those two kings, Sihon and Og, were driven out from before you. It was not by your sword or by your bow. That's Joshua 24:12. So if this insect language refers to human armies, that doesn't really work with Joshua 24:12, because the verse very specifically says, you didn't win these battles by your sword and your bow. You know, so you can't really make that equation here, even though it happens, you know, elsewhere, you know, in the Old Testament. Now, frankly, those three views, literal insect warfare, a plague carried by insects, or this is a metaphor for human armies, none of those views really has anything going for it, sad to say. The most lengthy study of this, and there aren't many, but there's a long one. It's by Edward Neufeld. It's entitled Insects as Warfare Agents in the Ancient Near East. And it covers Exodus 23:28, Deuteronomy 7:20, Joshua 24:12, and then a passage in Isaiah as well. And it's in the journal Orientalia, volume 49, number 1. It's a 1980 article. It's 27 pages long, so it's a substantive study of this. But honestly, it's pretty unsatisfying. Basically, you read this whole article, and there's no evidence for ancient Near Eastern armies using insects in warfare or a metaphorical meaning for insects in that literature, ancient Near Eastern literature. There's only one clear reference to an ancient Near Eastern king being referred to by insect language. That's Pharaoh. He of the bee is one of Pharaoh's titles. But it's pretty clear that God didn't use Egyptians to drive out the Canaanites in the conquest. That's very obvious. So you might wonder what Neufeld does in nearly 30 pages, you know, 27 pages, if all that's the case. Here's his conclusion. This is why it's really unsatisfying. He writes, though more evidence is needed, this discussion points to the strong possibilities and the use of insects as warfare agents goes back to prehistoric times. This is actually where he camps in the article for a long time. And this type of weaponry belonged to early man's natural objects, such as those made from wood or stone. The biblical narratives in question seem to be accurate recalls. Okay, I'm emphasizing certain words for very deliberate reason. Now, the biblical narratives in question seem to be accurate recalls, blurred by strong sentiments of warfare episodes of a far distant past, which were lived through. You know, long-cherished tradition changed them into glorious events, and the narratives called up their remembrance and reinstate them in concrete imagery. They're part of a group of ideas associated with end products from the very ancient past's functioning institutions and warfare experiences. Originally, some of the events took strong hold of the imitative imagination and gradually became an integral part of the actual stream of consciousness of national life of ancient Israel. Hence, these accounts represent the continuity of consciousness of past perceptual experiences revived as images in a new setting. At the ideational level, it is almost reliving the past, dominated by an emotionally charged situation of new developments. In this sense, these events lived on in history. They had a cumulative impact upon the need to assess ambitions and to renew traditions. That's the end of the quote. In other words, the biblical writer is reminiscing about a speculative past. It's speculative because it's prehistorical. There's no written records for any of this. So the biblical writer is reminiscing about a speculative past and just sort of projecting that on either his current circumstances or the circumstances of Israel's entry into Canaan. That's all he's got. You know, like they were influenced by something they may have thought happened in the past. That's the way they wrote this. Again, it's very, very unsatisfying. It feels kind of made up, let's be honest with you. It's the best he can do, I guess, you know. And while it's true that ancient people, okay, these are eras more recent than the Old Testament period, you know, the conquest and the monarchy. Ancient people did use insects. There's just nothing to lean on here for the biblical era. Now, if you want an article on this, I think this one's available online. Adrienne Mayer, this is the same scholar who wrote the first Fossil Hunters about the misidentification of dinosaur bones as giants in antiquity. Adrienne Mayer wrote Greek Fire, Poison Arrows, and Scorpion Bombs, Biological and Chemical Warfare in the Ancient World. That's a 2008 title. And she focuses on the Greco-Roman period. So it's much later. But so ancient people did this. But all that Neufeld's got in his article is, well, this must be a prehistoric memory. Okay, again, it's just not very satisfying. Now, I would say, again, in light of all that, I think it's just easier to let verse 27 inform verse 28. Verse 27, I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from among you. Tegay, in his commentary on Deuteronomy, summarizes how it would work to let verse 27 inform verse 28. He's actually writing about Deuteronomy 7:20, you know, that particular description, because this is a commentary on Deuteronomy. But this is really, I think, really well said. So he's talking about the Hebrew word tsir'ah, which is this word for hornet. Now he writes, a more likely translation is hornets or wasps, as in rabbinic Hebrew, since that is the only actually attested meaning of the word. Literally, the text would mean that ferocious swarms of wasps will hunt down the remaining Canaanites and sting them to death. Some commentators compare this to instances of populations driven from their homes by swarms of ferocious insects. Another possibility is that Sir'ah is a metonymy for panic or frenzy, like that caused by wasps, and means that God will cause the remaining Canaanites to panic and flee or be caught. Now, honestly, that makes a lot of sense with verse 27. He has a footnote. He adds this. An apt parallel to the present case is Greek oistros, which means both horsefly and vehement passion, madness, and frenzy. And he cites a passage from the Odyssey, where Athena causes Odysseus's foes to panic and stampede like a herd of cattle driven wild by a horsefly. It's imagery, okay? In this case, the meaning of Sir'ah is similar to Mechuma, turmoil, in verse 23, or Ema, terror, in Exodus 23, 27, and elsewhere. That's the end of Tegay's footnote. So where does this leave us? You know, sending the hornet, the Sir'ah, before the Israelites, I'm going to suggest, simply means that God would strike the inhabitants of the land with psychological and perhaps irrational fear. Again, reading it in light of verse 27. And so in Joshua 24:12, Joshua reminds the people, and he's the voice of God there, that the victories they gained weren't brought about by foot soldiers and weapons. God was immediately involved. Let's go to verses 30 through 33. I'll read them again. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the Euphrates, for I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Now verse 30, little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. Verse 30 sounds like, and it's been taken this way by a lot of scholars, it sounds like a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts. In other words, it has the feel of something added to the text after Israel's failure at the end of Joshua's life. And when the set of conditions, this little by little thing, the set of conditions emerge as Israel enters into the period of the judges. This sounds like the circumstance of the period of the judges when that period starts after Joshua dies, because the job isn't done. So this sounds like it was sort of prophesying that or foreshadowing that. Little by little feels like quite a contrast to other promises in the Torah to drive out the inhabitants. This is the only place you're going to get this little by little language, okay, or at least maybe one or two places. It seems to already know, that the text, the writer, seems to already know that the Israelites failed to believe and trust in Yahweh, and so the land would be rid of the targeted people groups little by little. And not only just little by little, but at a time when Israel has increased, which would be later. Again, period of the judges, maybe the monarchy, something like that. That's a circumstance, again, that just fits Israel's later history, sometime later than the days of Moses or Joshua. Okay. Now, one could, on the other hand, say that the passage presumes all this, but, you could just say that this is a foreshadowing. But again, that still leaves you with the issue of other statements about where God says he's going to drive out the inhabitants of the land. So, which is it? Is it a foreshadowing, or is it something that was added later to explain the failure of Israel, or to sort of link the failure of Israel back to, God's original desire, and promise to have them drive these people out of the land? Sarna writes this: this passage qualifies the foregoing promises, which imply the speedy conquest of the entire land. That would leave large areas of the country uninhabited because the people of Israel was insufficiently numerous to fill the void that would be created following the expulsion of the native population. Deuteronomy 7:22 gives the same explanation. So there you have, the one other case here. The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You may not make an end of them at once, lest the wild beasts grow too numerous for you. Sarna continues, that the initial campaigns were unable to complete the conquest is explicitly stated in the books of Joshua and Judges. This historic reality generated varied responses. Judges 2, 20, 20 and 21 explains it as a divine punishment for infidelity to the covenant. Judges 2, 22 through 23 and Judges 3, 1 and 4 see it as a means of trying Israel's faith. And Judges 3, 2 understands the protracted nature of the conquest as a prudent strategy for training successive generations in the art of warfare. Let me read you Judges 3, 2. It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before. That's why it took so long to drive them out of the land, despite a number of places in the Torah where it has an immediate feel. So the whole issue is this. There are places in the Torah where the conquest has a feel of this is going to be quick, that God's going to just wipe them out. And then there are places like where we're camped on here that, you know, I'm not going to drive them out quickly. It's going to be little by little. And then you have different reasons, you know, for this. So again, what do we do with that? Again, your two options are, this is a foreshadowing. Okay. It's a foreshadowing of what's going to happen. Or again, these qualifications are a means by which a later writer who's like living in the situation is trying to understand, okay, well, you know, why didn't this happen quickly? Okay. It's because they did enter into covenants with them. They did follow the other gods. You know, this was good. It was providential too, because then the successive generations learned what it means to fight in war. So we actually got a good army out of this. In other words, you know, neither is unhistorical. It's just one is sort of a theologization of history after the fact to explain or to at least apply the set of conditions and kind of align them with the original statements about God saying, I'm going to drive these people out of the land. You know, well, okay, why are we still here doing this? Well, I'll tell you why. And so that gets worked out, gets explained in books like Joshua and Judges, which are written after the time of Joshua. Joshua, there's no indication he wrote the whole book. The book never claims that. He certainly didn't write Judges. So whoever wrote that could have sprinkled a little of that in certain passages, Deuteronomy 7, here in Exodus 23, to let the reader know, okay, this is what messed things up. And again, it might read as a foreshadowing, but again, someone else could just read it like we've done here and just said, okay, the writer or a subsequent editor is trying to link these two things, trying to link what happened, you know, what the set of circumstances are in the book of Judges. I mean, here we are. This is our reality with, again, God's desire to drive out the inhabitants of the land. You know, why wasn't it quick? Why didn't it work? Well, here's why. So, again, it's another good example of things in not only the Torah, but, you know, books that are sort of related to this time period. We need to be thinking about, way back at the first episode, what does history mean? You know, how does inspiration work? Is God allowed to prompt someone to connect passages this way? Of course he is. Again, inspiration is a process. It is not an event. Process, not an event. God, you know, wants certain things done certain ways, and he will bring people along to do that so that the finished product, again, gets his approval. Okay, good job. You know, anybody who reads this now is going to know why things didn't work out. Okay, so again, it's just one of those things that we keep encountering this kind of thing in Exodus, where we have to really think about how do we think about, you know, history and inspiration, all these other things, because a lot of this doesn't conform to the way we would do it. Well, it's just too bad that, you know, God didn't prompt one of you to write this, you know, isn't it? You know, or me. He didn't do that. God prompted the people. You know, way back then, you know, either boots on the ground people or people who came a little bit afterwards. You know, God has his own reasons for doing this sort of thing. Again, how do we frame the whole discussion of inspiration, historicity, and whatnot? And none of this, you know, violates either, again, in my book. And if you need sort of an introduction to how should we think about historicity and all this kind of stuff, really the first episode in this whole series, again, this is why that episode's important. you know, trying to show it's really about how our thinking is framed. You know, what, you know, are we going to impose the way we would do something on the text, or are we just going to let it be what it is? I mean, fundamentally, that's the question. And you want to impose the way you do it on the text? Well, good, you know, be warmed and filled. You know, you can do that. But again, as I brought up in that first episode, I challenge you to write an objective history of yourself. See if you can do that and meet the modern standards for all this. Again, if that piques your interest, good. Go back and listen to the first episode of this of the Exodus series. If you've already listened to it, hope that jars your memory. And you know, I think you can still get something out of it if you went back and listened to it, because you know, again, we keep running into these things. Verse 31. I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. This is the parameters of the land, okay? And I've already made the comment in the podcast that not every place in the Torah or elsewhere where the dimensions of the land are mentioned, they don't all agree. And there are different, you know, reasons for that, but just, again, so you're aware of that. Sarna notes of this particular instance, he writes this, "The ideal boundaries of the land are now set forth. As in Genesis 15, 18 through 21, the ethnographic description of verses 23 and 28 is supplemented." Ethnographic refers to the people groups. "The ethnographic description of verses 23 and 28 is supplemented by a closer geographic definition. At no time in Israelite history, even at the height of the Davidic Solomonic Empire, were these boundaries a reality." Now, he has a footnote at this point. "David and Solomon asserted political and economic hegemony as far north as the Euphrates," 1 Kings 5:1. So that is true. I mean, that's mentioned. "But neither David or Solomon dispossessed the local peoples and settled Israelites in their stead." This is, of course, an issue. Again, this is me now. This is, of course, an issue that has some relevance for eschatology. And you know, long ago, I did a series on why an obsession with, you know, end times, with eschatology is a waste of time. This is one of the topics, because the issue of what exactly is the promised land, because the dimensions, you know, they're not always the same, you know, when you look at the descriptions. So what is the promised land? And that's, you know, it's a fundamental question. What are we talking about here? And then, okay, if we could figure out what it is, did Israel ever get that? Because there are going to be people who say, well, they all, you know, the kingdom promises, the promise of the land was fulfilled. And so we don't need to look for a later fulfillment, like in premillennial eschatology or something like that. You know, so there are people who want to see the land promises as already fulfilled or, again, abstracted in the church. That's a different trajectory, but. The fact of the matter is that the specifics of at least this passage and a few others, Genesis 15, for example, these dimensions were never actually met in Israel's history. And so, you know, again, a certain view of eschatology can use this information to argue for, you know, again, a future literal, you know, 1,000-year reign or something like that. I mean, there are like 10 other issues that go into all this, so that this is not like a slam dunk or anything like that. It's far from it. Because then you can ask the question, did Israel as a people sin away the promises? Because you do have Leviticus 26 that says, if you do X, Y, or Z, I'm going to expel you from the land. And of course, we know that happened. So should we even be having the land discussion? Well, they came back from exile. Yeah, two tribes did. But if you actually read in the prophets, the restoration from exile doesn't involve just two. Okay, there are a number of passages that view restoration, healing from exile, the end of the exile, as all of the tribes. And so then the other side of the end times question, say, yep, that's right. Go to Acts chapter 2. Jews scattered all over the world, not just, you know, the ones that were put in, you know, put and stayed, you know, in Babylon or Persia or something like that. Okay, Jews from all over the Mediterranean that had been scattered abroad, their ancestors, return to the land. Okay, and they hear the gospel, they go back, and this is the beginning of the kingdom. The kingdom of God, as related to Jesus, and frankly as related to Eden, is not just a place in the Middle East the size of New Jersey. It's the whole world. And so all of this kingdom talk is not about a future millennium you know, where that's like Israel. All that talk, you know, it should be viewed through the lens of the work of Jesus and the foundation of the church and the Great Commission, which ultimately is supposed to take us back to Eden. The whole world is God's. So again, this land question becomes a factor. I just wanted to briefly mention it. If you're interested in the eschatology series, you can always go, you know, look that up on my website. But here you have, again, an instance where the parameters of the land are mentioned. So I thought I would, you know, throw that in. Now, verse 32, you shall make no covenant with them and their gods. Some scholars want this to be, again, added later, like we just talked about a few verses earlier, because of the Gibeonite deception in Joshua 9. The Gibeonites deceive Joshua and then into making a covenant with them. But, you know, this statement taken just as it is certainly could have been a precursor to that or a foreshadowing. So it doesn't really solve anything. And this brings us to the final item, you know, for today's episode. Just a few comments on the people groups of verses 23 and 28. I'll just read those two verses again. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, I will blot them out. Verse 28, I will send hornets before you and drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. Now these lists, there's two of them here, are two of 14 Old Testament expulsion lists, as scholars call them, lists of pre-Israelite occupants to be expelled from the land. Now, those lists do not always agree in content or order, and they really have to be viewed as sort of summative in nature, not exhaustive, you know, any one of them. Now, the major study on these matters is a hard-to-find article, Tomoo, that's T-O-M-O-O, Ishida, the Japanese scholar, Tomoo Ishida. It's called The Structure and Historical Implications of the Lists of Pre-Israelite Nations. Now, it's from the journal Biblica, which has a lot of the issue, its issues online. So you can go look that up. Biblica, volume 60, number 4, 1979. And it's, you know, 30 pages long. So it's a substantive study. And the content of that, you know, all the expulsion lists is well beyond this episode. There are, of course, other people group terms. Now, think about that. So you get this these list of expulsion, you know, terms, those people groups that are supposed to be expelled. You get that. But there are other people group terms not listed in those who are targeted not just for expulsion, but elimination. And a number of these are people who happen to be unusually tall. Again, they're described this way. Let me give you a list. Anakim, Rephaim, the Amorites, Amos 2, 9, and 10, for their height, the Zuzim, the Zamzumim, the Amim, the sons of Raphah, you know, Goliath and his brothers. Okay, none of those terms show up in the expulsion lists, but they're nevertheless part of the picture. And there's still a third group. There are other targeted people groups in terms of elimination, you know, that are supposed to be driven out from the land, that are neither present in the expulsion list nor collectively or directly described as unusually tall. Philistines, okay? Kerethites, Pelethites, Carians, Kaphtorim, the Avim, the Amalekites, the Horites, the Geshurites, the Gerzites. I mean, all these peoples are, you know, end up being part of the conquest narratives in some way. Now, in my session last August, middle of August in Lubbock, I focused on identifying these people groups as a way of showing the coherence of the view I took in Unseen Realm, and that is that the specific killing episodes in the conquest narratives targeted the descendants of the Nephilim. They're the ones that are specifically targeted, not everybody else. And again, the short version of that view is there are more than verbs of killing associated with the conquest commands. There's drive out, you know, expel, drive away, you know, cast away. You know, all there are different Hebrew lemmas here. They're not all just verbs of killing. When you actually look up where the verbs of killing occur, geographically, they're in the same areas, regions, you know, even, you know, more specifically than that, cities, where the Anakim or other unusually tall people are said to have been spotted or known to be. I don't think that's a coincidence. Again, the conquest itself begins with a giant clan, Sion and Og, because in the Transjordan, we're told in Deuteronomy 2 and 3 that, hey, the descendants of Esau have taken care of most of these people. They got rid of the Amim and the Zamzumim and, you know, people like they were Rephaim and they come from the Anakim, you know, all this kind of stuff. But God tells Moses and Joshua, I want you to go up to Bashan And there are the last vestiges of these folks, the last of the Rephaim there, and the Amorites. Amorites is a very, very important term here. And that's where they're sent. In the Transjordan, that's it. This is the vestige of these guys. The Anakim, Rephaim, the Anakim, again, who come from the Nephilim, you know. So when you get into the land, I mean, Transjordan's taken care of with Bashan. You go into the land, and guess what? You know, this, just play it out. The conquest happens this way. And you get to Joshua 11, when Joshua defines, you know, what victory is in the conquest. There are no more Anakim in the land. Okay, again, I don't think these things are coincidental. These are pieces of a matrix of ideas. So I'm not going to repeat my Lubbock content here. Okay, there's no way I could. This is actually one of the topics I'm thinking about doing on the Naked Bible Cruise, you know, going through that material step by step. Not sure about that yet, but I can say at this point, again, that you can take all of these names in all these expulsion lists, the tall list, the ones that don't fit on either of those, you can take all of these names and associate them with pre-Israelite invasions by peoples who not only all had giant traditions, but their literary traditions about giants and about, you know, certain descendants of giants, they're all traceable back to Babel and Babylon, the anti-Eden, the ground zero of supernatural chaos tradition in the mind of the Old Testament writers. I don't think that's coincidental either. Now, that might sound weird. Well, how can you get all those names to fit in that bucket? It's actually several buckets. The groups, the major groups are Amorites, the Hittite Hurrian group, and the Sea Peoples. Those are the three buckets. Those three buckets, those three, you know, big umbrella groups, you can fit all of the people group names and the conquest narratives into one of those groups, and they were all in Canaan before the Israelites got there. They all have giant traditions. They all, you know, from before the flood. You know, they cross-fertilize each other, and they're all traceable back to Babylon. The Amorites, I mean, I'm just throwing stuff out here now. Did you realize that Hammurabi was an Amorite? that's just me saying, I mean, you go to the Mesopotamian literature, that's where he comes from. Because the Amorites, who are from, you know, roughly Syria, we'll just call it Syria, they migrated down not only into Canaan, but they swept through Babylon, through Mesopotamia. And at one point, basically all of the city-states of Mesopotamia were run by Amorite kings. It's no coincidence that Og of Bashan back in Canaan, he uses the title, you know, King of the Amorites. Why? Because he wants to be linked to part of this tradition, and is in various ways. Again, Hammurabi was an Amorite king. And this is where you get the literature about the Apkallu. It's the immediate precursor to Genesis 6, 1 through 4. I mean, this is how this works. There's a conceptual matrix going on here that is associated with the pre-Israelite occupants of the land. And we get vestiges of that in Deuteronomy 2 and 3, in Numbers 13, 32, you know, and 33. The Anakim who are from the Nephilim, you know, and the links to the Anakim and the Rephaim. And all of this is just a big pool of ideas. It's inherently theological. It's inherently about chaos and anti-Eden traditions. And that is the way the conquest is framed. And you can get the gist of that in Unseen Realm, but this is something I'm going to be working on for years. What you get in Unseen Realm is the skeleton of it. There's a lot that's going on here. I want to just illustrate a little bit and take 5 minutes and illustrate the terminology issue. Let's take Canaanite. A term like Canaanite, frankly, encompasses all of the other ones. So we have these three buckets, Amorites, Hittite, Hurrian, Sea Peoples. They move into Canaan. Guess what? If you're an occupant of Canaan, you are a Canaanite. Canaanite is not a distinct ethnic group. It means occupant of Canaan. And we actually get this in Genesis 10, 15 through 20. Now, let me read this to you. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, and the Arvadites, and the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Afterward, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed, and the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar as far as Gaza, and in the direction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, as far as Lasha. These are the sons of Ham by their clans, their languages, their lands and their nations. Well, I thought they were Canaan. On verse 20, the reference to the sons of Ham, recall that Canaan was fathered by Ham. Genesis 9, 20 through 27. We did a whole episode in the podcast on that. Canaan was cursed, not Ham, in that passage, resulting in his subjugation by the Shemites, who are not exclusively Semites either. Read Genesis 10, 21 through 30. He's also subjugated to the Japhethites. You know, since there are people groups who can be subsumed under the Amorite, the Mitanni, Hurrian, Hittite, and Sea people migration or invasions, it's tempting to see this curse as playing out in history via those invasions. And I'll list what I mean by that is, if you look at the list, Genesis 10 there, okay, it's obviously not just people giving birth to baby people, okay? Who does Canaan father? Canaan. He fathers Sidon, that's Phoenicia. Heth, that's the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, that's North Syria, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites. Apparently, you know, again, the Amorites from Irkutah, you know, that's the Arkites, the Arvidites and all this stuff. I don't want to get too far into the weeds here. Arvidites are also Phoenicia. Sinites, again, that word shows up in Ugaritic, south coast of Ugarit, which is near Syria. Again, that's the Amorite, you know, locale and all that kind of stuff. Genesis 10 is not about just human biological reproduction and physical lineages, ethnic lineages. It's about the inheritance, the heritage of places. These places are going to be occupied by a wide range of people, including Hittites and Amorites and whatnot. Again, the importance of all this is that the passage, Genesis 10, gives us a picture of what people groups constituted the land of Canaan. It's not about biology and genetics. It's about geography. It's the table of nations. It's not the table of genetic relationships. It's the table of nations. Okay, Genesis 10 gives us a picture of what people groups constituted the land of Canaan. The passage, again, is about geography, not biology. The names in Canaan's lineage, his quote-unquote lineage, in this passage show up in the conquest expulsion lists, which target people occupying the land prior to Israel's arrival. The passage also links Canaan with the Amorites. It establishes, whatever this means, that the Amorites are in some way synonymous with Canaanites. Again, Canaan was home to the Amorites because of the Amorite invasions, and so Amorites are Canaanites. And there's more nuancing to this, but I'm just giving you the rough sketches. Terms like Hittite, Hivite, Amorite, Jebusite are used as synonyms or subsets of Canaan in passages like Genesis 36, 2 and 3. Ezekiel 16, 3, this is a great verse. Say, thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth are the land of the Canaanites. Your father was an Amorite, and your mother a Hittite. It means that Jerusalem was in a land called Canaan that was Amorite and Hittite. But they're all Canaanites because Amorites and Hittites settling in Canaan are Canaanites. Okay, and a lot of these terms overlap. You know, the Sea peoples are part of this. The Philistines and other, you know, other people names you listed earlier are pre-Israelite occupants. So the Philistines are actually also Canaanites. Okay, in that sense. See, we tend to look at these names and think biology. We think biological descent, genetics, and because we're moderns. This stuff is about geography. And the geography is affected by people, yes, people who were living in the land of Canaan before Israel ever got there. And Canaan, the descendant of Noah, okay, and hence the land named by extension, the land named after him is going to be cursed by God. And so you can actually look at the conquest as, again, the fulfillment, part of the fulfillment of that curse. You know, and why, you know, is Canaan cursed? You know, why, you know, it gives us a link back to the flood. You know, again, the Amorites themselves, the people who come here, the Amorites, the Hittite Hurrians, the Sea peoples, they all bring with them not only their own, again, giant traditions, their own, you know, literature about themselves and their relationship to Babylon and the pre and post flood Apkallu, you know, the survival of the civilization of Babylon, all that stuff. you know, the Hittite Hurrian stories of primeval history, they're drawn, you know, from the earlier Sumerian and Akkadian and Mesopotamian stuff. It's the same thing with the Sea Peoples, the Aegean. They're from the Aegean. Okay, the Aegean stories about all this stuff are drawn from earlier Mesopotamian, i.e. Babylonian material. Again, this is a whole complex matrix of ideas. If you're an ancient people group and you're writing this material or you're reading it after the fact, you know where these people, you know what the spiritual, the theological labeling and heritage of these people groups are. If you are a literate reader of the Hebrew Bible, you know this. And it helps inform you as to why these people groups get named in expulsion lists and why a number of them are targeted for destruction. Because they are in a theological stream and a historical, you know, boots on the ground stream of tradition about peoples who descended from the flood by virtue of the bad guys. Again, if you're an Israelite, by virtue of rivals to Yahweh, again, who in their religion and your religion, they were raised up by supernatural seed. You know, this is the story. This is the storyline. This is the content. This is the material. This is the theology. And again, what I tried to do in Unseen Realm is to, again, just give people the skeleton of this. But this is how the conquest needs to be framed. The people group names are important. Who they ultimately descend from geographically. I mean, there's no way you can do this ethnographically. You're real limited there. You can do a little bit. But geographically, geography is the issue, because geography puts you in a place. And when you're in that place, that place has their religion, their traditions, and those religions and traditions are traceable back to Babylon, who is the chaos agent, the anti-Eden, the force of everything against the way God wants it for Genesis 1 through 11, and really for the rest of the Bible, and the Torah especially. All of these things concatenate together. They're not accidental. They're not random. They're not meaningless. It's just that we don't have really any of that frame of reference in our heads. So we read these things in a different way. And what I'm trying to do, again, the start of it in Unseen Realm, the Lubbock Conference, and again, I'm going to be working on this for years. This is coherent, taken on its own terms. And it helps us intelligently discuss what the thinking was when Israel's going in to take the land, what they thought about the commands to, you know, when you're in this place, these people are devoted to destruction. I mean, some of these, you know, again, there's expulsions, you know, you can drive this, you know, but here specifically, we have, you know, Cherem, devote to destruction. This is an offering back to the Lord. Why would God do that? It's because of where these, again, it's because of all these connections, the geographical, the theological, the religious, you know, connections. That's why. That's how a writer and a reader would have framed this kind of material. So we miss all of that. And a lot of scholars and theologians today don't even think about it. They never run into it. So it's not part of how they, you know, try to address these passages. And that, you know, that's not like a sin or anything. I'm just saying, telling you that's just the way it is. But we're going a different route, and we have good reasons for going there and for framing it that way. But this is a work in progress. But here again, since we're in Exodus 23, you run into this stuff, and there it is, and this becomes part of the picture. So next time, we're going to hit Exodus 24. I don't know if we're going to spend one or two episodes on that, because we have the covenant ceremony, then the divine banquet tradition. There's just a lot packed in, especially to the second one, that's really important and is going to be new to a lot of people. So we'll see. It's either going to be one or two parts, Exodus 24.
And when can we expect Unseen Realm 2 to come out, Mike, again? I didn't hear that.
Who knows? Who knows?
That's a serious question.
Who knows?
All right.
Well, yeah, that's a serious answer.
Yeah. Well,
it's not a flippant answer. It's a real answer.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Well, sounds good. All right. Well, hopefully everybody's enjoying themselves at the conference, Mike, including us. And yep. If you didn't make it or catch the live stream, you can always watch it on demand by going to nakedbibleconference.com. We hope you join us one way or the other. And Mike, we'll look forward to Exodus 24 next week. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.